Listening to A Different Lens, a bi-monthly podcast produced by the Hampton Institute.
All right, I'll begin introducing myself a little bit. So, Jeremy Hammond. I kind of began my research into U.S. foreign policy after 9/11 because, I just asked myself, I didn't really know a whole lot. I probably had above average knowledge about world events and things, but didn't understand 9/11. I asked myself, why would people do this? And was unsatisfied with the answer given by the politicians and George Bush saying that, well, it's because they hate our freedoms. So at the same time, I happened to move to Taiwan at that time in my life. I was teaching over there. So I was on the internet a lot, and I was just researching and started digging. And, it soon became evident that, it was 9/11 was blowback for U.S. foreign policy. So I just started digging into what we're doing in the Middle East and what we have been doing for, many, many decades in the Middle East. And of course, obviously, the subject of Israel and Palestine was central to that question of U.S. foreign policy. So, I started researching that extensively. In 2008, I launched Foreign Policy Journal. And one of the first, early on, just a couple months after that, I had launched that site, I published an article talking about the U.S. role in supporting Israel's Operation Cast Lead, which was its 22-day military assault against Gaza, starting December 27th, 2008, and ending January 18th, 2009. And for that article, I received the Project Censored Award. A little bit later, I wrote a shorter book called The Rejection of Palestinian Self-Determination, which kind of examines mandate-era Palestine and the roots of the conflict. And currently working on a major project is Obstacle to Peace, the U.S. role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So that's my forthcoming book.
Okay. Here we're going to talk about your latest book. What's it called, and why did you want to write it?
So again, the title is Obstacle to Peace, and the U.S. role in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a subtitle. And I had kind of wanted to, this is kind of, the roots of this book were kind of during Operation Cast Lead. I was following that massacre very closely. I immediately wanted to write a book about that. And I kind of started a little bit, started some writing for that, but when I started the writing for that, I thought, well, people need to know the history of the conflict to be able to understand events today. We need to understand the roots. So that was actually how the rejection of Palestinian self-determination evolved. That was kind of just research I compiled about the roots of the conflict, and I decided, well, initially I was going to do an article about it, and it just turned into a small book, so I just published it as a book, and that's actually where that came about. And then it was a couple more years before I was able to kind of return to my idea of writing the book about Operation Cast Lead. In May 2011, Obama gave a speech, a now famous speech, where he mentioned the 1967 lines as serving as the basis for a peace agreement and a border agreement between Israel and Palestine. And I was just really shocked at the response to the speech because, the mainstream media, it was all unanimous that, gosh, this represents a shift in U.S. foreign policy. And there were two things that were remarkable about that to me. One is that, if Obama saying that the 1967 lines should serve as the basis for borders, if that's a shift in policy, what does that say about the previous policy? Well, that tells us that the previous policy rejected the two-state solution, because the two-state solution is based on the 1967 lines, with minor and mutually agreed changes to the final border. So there's that, because, obviously there's this cognitive dissonance among mainstream analysts that they, on one hand, they would insist that the U.S. has long supported the two-state solution. But on the other hand, here they are saying that when Obama says the 67 line should serve as the basis, suddenly they're saying, well, this is a shift in policy. So this is extreme cognitive dissonance. And the second thing that was interesting about the response was what Obama actually said and what he didn't say. And he said that the 67 lines will serve as the basis, but he also said very clearly, in fact, he gave it a speech. This was during his famous Cairo speech. The 67 lines was May 2011. And then immediately after that speech in May 2011, at the State Department, not in Cairo, State Department, he gave a speech at AIPAC where he went into further detail about what exactly he meant by that. And he explained that, well, what this means is that, you know, we have the 67 lines, but since 1967, Israel has built all these settlements in the West Bank, and so therefore, you know, Israel is going to absorb many of these settlements in the final agreement. So it was very clear what he meant by that, and that is not the two-state solution. And we have to, you know, Israel and the U.S. rather, they talk about a two-state solution. A two-state solution is not the same thing as the two-state solution. When I say the two-state solution, I'm talking about the international consensus based on international law. One important document is Resolution 242 after the 1967 war that called on Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories. That's the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the Golan Heights, which are Syria, and the Sinai Peninsula, which was Egypt. But, you know, speaking of Palestine, it's the West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory. So Resolution 242 called on Israel to withdraw. This is the basis for a settlement. Israeli withdrawal to the June 1967 lines, and into the occupation. And then an agreement, a final agreement based on those borders, with the possibility of minor and mutually agreed changes to the final borders. That's the two-state solution. When Obama says, well, you know, we're going to base it on the 67 lines, but what that means is that Israel is going to annex major settlement blocks, that's not the two-state solution. Israel has no right to annex any settlement blocks. All of these settlements are built illegally. They're all on Palestinian territory, on land that has been illegally confiscated from the Palestinians. Their homes bulldozed, families kicked out, and Jewish homes built in their place. So we have, that's another major thing we need to understand when we people get media reports about the conflict and they hear about the two-state solution, and what Israel is suggesting when it talks about a Palestinian state is not the two-state solution. What Israel wants is to absorb the major settlement blocks and annex them and leave Palestinians with a West Bank that's divided up between Jewish highways and Bantustan-like blocks with no sovereignty over their own borders, with an Israeli military presence along the Jordan River, no sovereignty over their own airspace. No ability for collective self-defense. They want a demilitarized Palestine, which means that Palestine would have no ability, to defend itself against Israeli incursions. They're basically demanding that the Palestinians surrender their right to self-defense, surrender the right of return of Palestinian refugees. In 1948-49, 750,000 Palestinians, Arab Palestinians, were ethnically cleansed from Palestine. This is the cause of the refugee crisis that still exists today. Under international law, it's customary international law recognized. This was recognized in General Assembly 194, General Assembly Resolution, the UN General Assembly, that the Arab refugees had a right to return to their homeland. Israel rejects this. It has since 1948 refused to allow refugees to return to their homes, which were immediately destroyed. But they won't even allow them to return to their former homeland, or provide compensation to the refugees. So these are kind of the main issues in the conflict. There's the question of borders. There's the question of refugees. And what Israel wants to do is turn it into a question of Israeli security. But security is a euphemism that is used to mean whatever Israel wants, and Israel wants the land, so therefore security means Israel needs the land, and it justifies taking the land stealing the land on the basis of security. So, you know, we need to recognize also that the use of this euphemism, which the U.S. also uses Israeli security as a euphemism for more Israeli theft of Palestinian land.
Okay. So, definitely brought up a lot of information there. And regarding Israel's motives, U.S. motives, separate from the Palestinians. So I wanted to ask, kind of start at the very beginning, so I want to ask, what exactly is Zionism? Because you hear about that a lot in the media, and what are its origins?
Okay. Yeah, Zionism is a political movement. It was the political movement pretty much considered the founder of Zionism, modern Zionism, is, what's the guy's name? It just escaped me.
Theodore Herzl.
Thank you. Yeah, Theodore Herzl. Who was a journalist? I think he was an Austrian journalist and a writer, and he wrote a book called The Jewish State, in which he outlined this Zionist goal of creating a homeland, national homeland for the Jewish people, and he had proposed actually a number of different places in the world where this state could be formed. Of course, Palestine was one of them. So Zionism was really this political goal of establishing a Jewish state, which, you know, Palestine became the target of that. So that was the late 1800s. The Zionism movement grew. You know, they established the Zionist National Congress, and they set up all kinds of organizations related to furthering this goal. You know, there was a lot of immigration during the British Mandate of Palestine. After World War I, Britain became the occupying power in Palestine, and the League of Nations created a mandate for Britain, basically just meaning that, you know, it recognized Britain as the occupying power there. Most people have heard of the Balfour Declaration, which was a promise from the British government to the Zionists, saying that, you know, the British policy was one of support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, which is a little bit in the British conception of it, is that's not statehood. They weren't saying that we support, you know, Jewish statehood or the Jewish takeover of Palestine. It was a national homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. Their concept of what that meant, as later outlined in the Churchill White Paper, was that, you know, there would be autonomous Jewish communities, you know, that were largely autonomous within Palestine. The British also later proposed the partition of Palestine. That was kind of the initial, the origin of that idea was from the British, which was later kind of picked up by the UN Special Committee on Palestine after the UN kind of replaced the League of Nations after World War II. It kind of took over the roles as far as the mandated territories were concerned. And every other one of the mandated territories became an independent state. They were recognized, their independence was recognized. Palestine was the only one of the formerly mandated territories whose independence was not recognized. And UNSCOP, which is the UN Special Committee on Palestine I just mentioned, they created a report. They looked at this issue and they created a report recommending that Palestine be partitioned so that a Jewish state could be created alongside an Arab state. And in that report, they explicitly rejected the right of the Arabs to self-determination. And they explained why, explicitly. They explained why that the Arabs in Palestine, the Arabs were the majority. They owned most of the land. Jews at that time owned about 5.8% of the land. By 1948, Jews only owned about 7% of the land of Palestine. But UNSCOP was clear in the reasons for rejecting the right of the Palestinians to self-determination by proposing that Arab land be taken from them and given to the Jews so the Jews could have a state. And the reason was that the idea of self-determination for the Arabs was contrary to the Zionist project. And the majority members of UNSCOP supported Zionism, and they were very explicit about that. It's right in the UNSCOP report. Anyone can go look it up on the UN website. and read that for themselves. The citations are in my book.
Okay. So kind of going off that, talking about postulants, we've heard time and again that postulants are a made-up people. You know, there has never been a Palestine. A Palestine has never existed. Tell us about the history of Palestinians and why that's a false narrative.
Yeah, this is something that you hear constantly from really ignorant people. You know, like, just, I run into this regularly. Just the last instance of it, some guy either on Twitter or Facebook or something, I don't remember, but some guy was challenging me, saying, you know, Palestinian nationalism didn't even, they weren't even, he said they weren't even called Palestinians until the 60s, when Palestinian nationalism was born. And I said, well, that's funny, because, you know, I can look back and find quotes from David Ben-Gurion, where he's talking about how the Palestinian national movement is an obstacle to the Zionist goal, back in the early 40s or late 30s. So that's interesting. That you know, it wasn't supposed to exist back then, but there's David Ben-Gurion, who was, of course, one of the Zionist leaders and the first prime minister of Israel. You know, there he is talking about Palestinian nationalism as an obstacle. So it's just a bunch of nonsense. It just really warrants no further comment than to say it's a bunch of nonsense. Anyone who knows anything about it knows it's nonsense. This idea that Palestinians don't exist or that Palestinian nationalism didn't exist. Another kind of argument along those lines is that, well, Jordan is the Palestinian state. This is one you probably heard too. So that, you know, Palestine was supposed to be the Jewish state, and it was actually Jordan that was the state of the Palestinian state. Well, this is, if you think about what this is saying, it's saying that, well, okay, so all the Arabs who were actually living in Palestine and knew Palestine as their home, not Transjordan. Which Jordan was formerly known, during the Mandate period, it was known as Transjordan, across the Jordan River. So, either, you know, their home was Palestine, not Transjordan. But this idea that they should just be happy just to pick up and move across the river over into Jordan, and, you know, that's supposed to be acceptable, that they should just leave because that's the Palestinian state. Palestine should be the Jewish state. I mean, the entire concept is racist, down to its core. You know, the entire, if you think about it, you know, the Zionist goal, even today, the Obama administration has had a shift in policy, which is that, you know, different from previous administrations, in that it has endorsed Israel's demand of the Palestinians that they recognize Israel as the Jewish state. This is profound.
I don't even think America recognizes Israel as a, like, in a sense, officially, as a Jewish state.
No, not officially, but the Obama administration has repeatedly referred to it as such, and they actually endorsed Netanyahu's demand of the Palestinians that they recognize Israel as such. And this is fundamentally racist position that, you know, is just so widely accepted today. That such that even the Obama administration has endorsed this idea that Israel should be, that it's important that Israel's identity as a Jewish state remain intact. And, you know, one of the demands placed on the Palestinians is that they recognize Israel as a Jewish state. This is one of the Netanyahu government's demands. Well, the reason for that is really simple. It's because it's the same reason that the Palestinians are expected and demanded by the United States and Israel to recognize Israel's so-called right to exist. So if Israel has a right to exist, Palestinians are supposed to recognize that. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Arab Palestinians from Palestine, was legitimate. And the unilateral declaration of the existence of the State of Israel on May 14th, 1948, was legitimate. But that declaration of independence of the State of Israel had no legal basis. This is really important. There was no legal basis for the Jews to declare that Palestine suddenly was a Jewish state. As I said before, at that time, the Jewish community owned less than 7% of the land. You know, but they're declaring for themselves that, that all this land that belongs to Arabs is now theirs. And they accomplished the actual de facto establishment of the state of Israel through that act of ethnic cleansing. And that's how the demographically Jewish state was born. They ethnically cleansed the Arab population. So that's what this euphemistic demand that the Palestinians recognize Israel's right to exist. This is what Israel wants, is it wants the Palestinians to just basically bow down and surrender and say, okay, we acknowledge that the ethnic cleansing and the unilateral declaration of the state of Israel was legitimate. But Palestinians aren't going to do that for the obvious reasons. So this is, you know, this is why there's this, this is why the so-called peace process doesn't ever go anywhere. Because the peace process, you know, we're supposed to believe that the peace process is the means by which, you know, the two-state solution is going to be implemented. Nothing could be further from the truth. The peace process, which has been recognized as such since Oslo, is the process by which Israel and the United States block implementation of the two-state solution. That's what it is. And, you know, this needs to be just really understood because there's way too much shortage, lack of understanding of that simple fact. That the two-state, that the peace process is a process by which the U.S. and Israel block the two-state solution from happening.
Okay, so going into a little bit about the UN partition plan, but I want to go kind of into the creation of Israel. We all know that a number of Arab states attacked Israel. However, I've also heard that Israel had plans, already had plans to go beyond the UN mandated borders. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very clear. Well, when Israel declared their state, first of all, this goes back to the UN partition plan. They cited one document as granting some kind of legal authority for the creation of their state. They cited UN Resolution 181, which was the UN General Assembly partition resolution. So what the General Assembly did was they took the UNSCOP report that I was talking about, and remember the UNSCOP report explicitly rejected the right of Palestinians to self-determination. The General Assembly took that report and that recommendation to partition Palestine, and they endorsed it. So Israel was citing that document, Resolution 181, as somehow conferring legal authority for their state. It did no such thing. First of all, General Assembly resolutions are not legally binding. All the General Assembly can do is make recommendations, unlike Security Council resolutions, which are binding on member states, legally binding. That's the first thing. The second thing is the General Assembly just made a recommendation. It did not claim for itself that it had actual authority to actually partition Palestine. All it could do was make the recommendation, and it did so. It recommended partition, and it referred the matter to the Security Council. It went to the Security Council, and it died there because members of the Security Council recognized that the UN had no authority to partition Palestine by force, and that the only way that the partition recommendation could be realized would be if it was accepted by both parties. Obviously, it wasn't accepted by the Arabs for the obvious reasons. The partition plan recommended taking enormous amounts of Arab land and handing it over to the Jews. The Jewish state was supposed to get 55% of the land in Palestine, even though the Jews only owned 7%, less than 7%, while the majority Arabs owned most of the land. So it was, you know, absurdly inequitable, this plan. But of course, you know, we're supposed to believe that the Palestinians missed an opportunity to have their own state at that time. But it was not an opportunity of any mean, of any kind. It was absurdly racist and ridiculous plan. That the idea that they thought that the Arabs might even accept something like that was itself grounded in racist thinking and colonial thinking of the times. So I might have been off track from your initial question there, but I think that was important back history as well. So there is no, you know, legal authority for that Israel's declaration of independence.
Okay. So there's no legal authority. Let's go back to Luke. Then thank you for that. Background, it's definitely important. But let's go back to the war, the Israeli-Arab War.
Oh,
in
right.
1947.
Yeah, right. Okay. So that's, I kind of forgot that was the initial question. So, yeah, what happened, you know, we're told that Israel declared its independence and then the Arab nations invaded to wipe Israel off the map. Well, this is really a bunch of nonsense, because what actually happened was, by the time Israel declared independence, May 14th, 1948, which they, you know, they timed to coincide with the end of the British mandate. The mandate expired, Israel declared its independence. By that time, 250,000 Arabs had already been ethnically cleansed, their villages destroyed. And then, it was only then that the neighboring Arab states managed to muster some kind of military response. So the Zionist ethnic cleansing operations were already well underway by that time. Massacres like the Dariusene massacre, you know, very famous, had already occurred. That occurred in April, the month before, you know, the Arab states were supposed to have started this conflict. You know, and many Palestinians fled out of fear of further such massacres, or were you know, expelled by the Zionist forces. Most of the fighting that occurred in the 1948 war actually occurred in areas that, under the UN partition plan, would have been part of the Palestinian state, part of the Arab state, not the Jewish state. You know, the Zionist forces were on the offensive in that war. So even though the largest Arab contingent, which was the Arab League, Jordan's Arab League, only managed to defend the area today known as the West Bank, and they kind of actually colluded with Israel and said, well, we're going to hold our ground here. You know, we won't try to defend other territory that we recognize Israel is going to basically annex. But we want the West Bank, and Jordan had territorial designs on the West Bank, and it sought to annex it. And so that was kind of a bit of a pact of sorts between Israel and Jordan at the time. And that goes to show, so that, you know, the supposed invasion of Israel by Arab states was really a reaction of the Arab states to the disenfranchisement and ethnic cleansing that was already going on by the Zionist forces of the Arab population.
Okay. So as this idea of the 1947 war, you suggest by Israel's action, because even today you'll hear that all the Arab states are trying to destroy Israel, you know, like if it's as a giant conspiracy, you know. All the Arab leaders are sitting in a room, smoking cigars, talking about their designs on Israel.
Yeah, right. Which manifests itself in things like, you know, Iran, this false propaganda that Iran wants to wipe Israel off the map and things like that. Yeah, we hear this all the time in different manifestations.
How is it used, this kind of idea? Because at least to me, the idea of these Arab states of Israel kind of being so-called surrounded by enemies comes from the occurrence of the 1947 war. How is that used to kind of justify Israel's actions today?
I'm sorry, how is it used to what?
To justify Israel's actions today.
Well, Israel justifies its actions, you know, based on this, as it always has. It's a common theme among, with Israel that, you know, its actions are justified by some kind of genocidal threat, going back to 1948. You know, this idea that the Arab Goliath invaded the Israeli David, you know, which is a myth. The same thing in 1967. It was supposed to be, you know, poor David was surrounded by this Arab Goliath in 1967. The truth is that Israel, that war began on the morning of June 5th, 1967. When Israel launched a surprise airstrike, a surprise air attack on the Egyptian Air Force and obliterated it while most of its planes were still on the ground. And when Israel, now we're told that was a preemptive attack. It was not a preemptive attack. By definition, it wasn't preemptive. Israel's own intelligence had assessed that Nasser had no interest in bloodshed, and they assessed that he wasn't insane, as he would have to be if he was going to actually dare to attack the much more powerful, militarily powerful state of Israel. Obviously the idea that the Arab states were just Goliath power, bent on, pushing the Jews into the sea and wiping Israel off the map. Israel defeated the combined Arab armies in 6 days. Israel was a major military power, and the Arab states had no chance against Israel, and they all knew it. And, the CIA, the U.S. intelligence community, agreed with Israel's assessment that Egypt wouldn't launch a first strike. In fact, the CIA, Johnson was informed that the war would begin with an Israeli attack on Egypt, not vice versa. So this whole idea that, this was a preemptive attack, this 1967 war was a defensive war by an Israeli act of self-defense, preemptive self-defense, it's a bunch of nonsense. But again, it's this idea of this threat. And, so again, today we're supposed to believe that the existence of Israel is, just existential threats to the existence of Israel, in the form of Iran and its nuclear program, which there's no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. So this hyping of this Iranian threat serves two purposes. One, it's this, again, this idea you mentioned of, it justifies its actions based on, this idea that it has to defend itself against these threats. Every action is Israel commits war crimes, and it calls it self-defense. Operation Cast Lead, numerous war crimes. It was basically a full-scale military assault against the civilian population and the civilian infrastructure. That's what it was. But, they justify it in the name of self-defense. So the Iranian threat serves that purpose. It's also a distraction from the Palestinian issue. Israel can go on, building illegal settlements and basically continuing the status quo in the West Bank, and also its illegal blockade of Gaza to punish the civilian population of Gaza. This can all go on, and while the world is distracted with these other issues. So it serves those purposes.
Yeah, it should be noted that what you said, Operation Cast Lead, Operation Cast Lead,
Operation Cast Lead, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the most recent one, Operation Defensive Edge, it's the same thing. It was kind of a replay. Even higher casualty, fatality rate among Palestinians this time around. Perhaps even more destruction of the infrastructure. Again, attacks on civilians sheltering in UN schools. There's a lot of it's kind of a repeat of Operation Cast Lead, only on an arguably greater scale.
Regarding the creation of Israel, why did the U.S. decide to support Israel? What was the real reasoning behind that?
Yeah, this is something that I personally haven't researched in great depth. But to me, in my assessment of it, I think it had a lot to do. It was really the Truman administration, in my view, it was the White House. Because if you look at the State Department and other agencies of the U.S. government, they were against supporting the Zionist project. But the Truman administration made the decision to recognize Israel within 15 minutes of its declaration of existence, and to support to support the Zionist project. The reasons for that, like there's a famous quote of Truman saying, I don't have, millions of Arab constituents. in other words, he has, he wants the Jewish vote, so he's going to do what's necessary to get the Jewish vote. I just actually watched a very interesting talk by Alison Weir of ifamericansknew.org, where she explains, the Supreme Court Justice, Brandes, I think his name is. I can't remember offhand, but he was a Zionist Jew, who was very influential in the Truman administration, and she argues that he had, you know, quite a bit of leverage over the thinking of Truman and persuaded him to support the Zionist project. So there's a lot of politics and things involved in that question. So, but you know, I think it's interesting though that the State Department, you know, advised against it, and Truman didn't listen to his State Department.
All right, good. Thanks. Tell us a bit about where we can find your book, and also where good resources to learn more about the Israel Palestinian.
Yeah, my current book, the Rejection of Palestinian Self-Determination. That one's available now, Amazon.com. So you can just search for Palestinian Self-Determination, and that one will come up. There's a paperback and a Kindle edition. The Obstacle to Peace. I don't have a publication date set yet, but it will be available on Amazon.com as well as bookstores. There'll be a hardcover, paperback, Kindle edition, as well as various other e-reader editions. So I'm going to make it as widely available as possible. And if anyone who wants to kind of keep updated with that book and be notified when it's available, can subscribe to my newsletter at jeremyrhammond.com.
All right, thank you for the interview.
All right, thanks, Devin. Nice to talk to you again.